The withholding system was approved in our nation in 1943, basically a way of helping to fund the war, but after the war was long over, the withholding system remained. What I'm talking about is money being removed from your paycheck before you ever receive your paycheck. You will notice that there are statements on the check saying this was withheld. Those are the taxes taken out by the government before you ever see your check. It is similar to the direct deposit system that the bank has. You may have money in your checking account and authorize your electric company to take money directly out of your checking account to pay your electric bill. Now, obviously, this is beneficial to the federal government. They get their money. This is profitable to the electric company. They get their money. But is there any benefit to us as consumers to set up such arrangements? They would say, well, you never have to think about it. It's convenient. You don't have to bother with a stamp or with mail or a chance of forgetting or missing a payment because the government takes its money before you ever see it, because the electric company takes its money before you know it, and so you don't have to think about it. Don't have to worry about that. Also, you never miss it, we are told, when it is removed. It's painless. You only look at the bottom line on your check. I made $700 this week. Not that $300 were taken out by the federal government. Or you get your final balance at the end of the month with your banking statement and says you have X amount in your checking account. Well, if it's beneficial to the government and it's beneficial to the electric company and it's beneficial to us as the consumers, did you ever think that maybe we should have a direct deposit for our church contributions? Wouldn't that be better for the church to draw its money directly out of our account and into their account? And the answer is no, absolutely not. And the reason is because this is part of our worship. This is something that we're supposed to purpose in our heart. That means we are supposed to think about it. If we can give our contribution without ever thinking about it, then there's something wrong. We're not worshiping properly. We are to give as we have been prospered. If my salary goes up one week or down another week, my contribution is going to go up or down. I can't have a constant amount being pulled out. There are benefits. Benefits of resisting covetousness. Benefits of focusing on the sacrifice of Jesus. It's to be done every first day of the week when we are assembled together. And how can that be done if it's being pulled in and out of accounts? And bountifully, we recognize how greatly we are blessed as we give every first day of the week. Now, I'm not really wanting to talk to you about the contribution, but rather the idea that we are living in an age of adaptable religion. And what I simply mean by that is instead of adjusting our life to follow Christ, we expect the church to adjust its practices to allow us to continue in the lifestyle that we've grown accustomed to. I remember a day when we were looking for air conditioning put in church buildings. And we would just do anything if we could get padded pews to make us more comfortable when we're at the assembly. Some of the young people would clamor for, I want some upbeat songs, you know, things that are a little more lively. And, of course, sermonettes, lessons that are 15 minutes or shorter, were being clamored for. And many congregations have all of these things now, and they're not wrong in and of themselves. But we need to ask ourselves, why is that so important? And if we didn't have the air conditioning or the padded pews, would we refuse to go to worship services? What about when we're vacationing? Some people on vacation act like 30 minutes for worship service is way more time than God deserves. After all, I'm on vacation. But I will give him 30 minutes. Now, that includes the time it takes me to get dressed, to get to the place where the assembly is, and for the assembly to take place. Got to get it done in 30 minutes. And so what a great many Christians have decided to do is, well, if we can't get them to come to worship service, we'll bring worship service to them. In the clearing of our campground, we will assemble. And you can just come wearing your fishing hat and your wading boots the way you are and sit down. We'll give you a 10-minute sermonette. We'll have one song. We'll take up a collection. And Lord's Supper will be handled real quickly. And you'll be in and out within 30 minutes. And again, I'm not saying that it's wrong for us to worship an assembly together that is not an organized congregation. But why would we want to do that? Because I don't want my vacation interrupted. Some have suggested the idea of, in fact, it happening some places, live stream worship into the home. Well, basically have a television camera here, and through your computer, you could watch the worship service live while it was going on. This would be great for those who are sick and can't get out, those who are shut-ins, those who are taking care of shut-ins and can't leave because of that caregiving. And it would be great for them. But you know what would happen if we got live stream worship? That certain members who are feeling perfectly fine think, I want to stay in my PJs. And I'd rather sip my coffee while I'm listening to the worship service. And I like my recliner better than those pews, padded or not. And I always like the idea that I can mute the sermon if he doesn't pique my interest in the first 2 minutes. Oh, sorry. And then after I do that, I can watch the news or something else and just keep one eye over there toward the computer. When I see he's done talking, I can turn back the worship service onto live. All you'd really have to have were the emblems in your home for partaking of the Lord's Supper. Even the song can be posted on the computer screen for you. And again, it's not wrong to have live stream worship into the home. But why would you want it? And what would you do with it if you had it? It's the idea of this church better adjust to my lifestyle, that I don't want to get out of bed that early, and I don't want to change into dress-up clothes, and so on and so forth. And I'm expecting the church to adjust to me. A month ago, we asked the question, do you really believe? And what we're talking about is, do you believe what God says in His Bible? Because a great many Christians have taken a casual attitude towards sin. It really doesn't bother me. Not my sin, not your sin. It really doesn't faze me. Judgment, I never think about it. Eternal destination, whether heaven or hell. No, I don't think I thought about it any time this week. After all, it's March Madness. And we just shut these things out of our mind. When Felix heard about temperance and righteousness and judgment, he trembled. Do we? Is this affecting us? Or have we become so intoxicated with our money and our entertainment, our work and our recreation, that's all we think about? And the church better adjust to our lifestyle if they want me to continue there as a member and put something in the contribution plate. We are so busy with this life that we never think about the afterlife. And I appreciate that heaven was mentioned in the prayer, and that Dusty sang songs referring to heaven as well. What happens when we are so selfish that we do not monitor our behavior? What happens to our health? It's destroyed, mental and physical health. What happens to our relationships? We have divorces and get fired from our employers. What happens to our children? They grow up having no interest whatsoever in spiritual things and may become as worldly, as wicked as people can possibly be. What happens to our Heavenly Father? He is hurt. And that is the most important aspect of it. When our behavior is not consistent with what the Scriptures teach, God is hurt. And that is going to result in the loss of your soul and mind. As we think about the world puts hell in the back of their minds and in the front of their vocabulary. Do you ever notice that? Hell is used all the time in conversation among people of the world, but they're never thinking about the actual place when they use that word. And I'm afraid within the church we have come halfway there. We've put hell in the back of our mind. It's not in the forefront of our vocabulary yet, but I expect it's coming. Hell is a real place. It's found in the Bible 54 times, and I know I've given this information to you in a previous lesson, but it bears repeating. 54 times in the King James Version, we have the word hell found. It is real. 31 times in the Old Testament, where the Hebrew word is Sheol, which simply means the grave, and does not necessitate a good or a bad, just a place that the departed spirits go to. In the New Testament, 10 times we have the word Hades, which equates to the word Sheol, referring to the grave. In the Old Testament, David prophesied that his soul would not be left in hell, Sheol. In the New Testament, Peter interprets that passage saying that Jesus' soul would not be left in Hades. Hades, Sheol, same place, talking about the grave. Jesus was not going to stay dead, and that's what David was prophesying about. One time, we have the word Tartarus, which means the place of torments in hell. So we have the Hadean realm and different segments of that realm, which we'll look at graphically in just a moment. In Luke, the 16th chapter, beginning at verse 19 through 31, we have the two places of Hades revealed to us. The rich man finds himself in the place called torments. This is the place where the departed angels go, according to 2 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 4. That's the one time we have the word Tartarus used. And that is where the rich man found himself in torment. Whereas Lazarus was carried to Abraham's bosom, the text tells us. Jesus refers to it as paradise, as he tells the thief on the cross, "Today thou shalt be with me in paradise." Now Jesus' body went into the grave. How did that guy go with him anywhere? Their spirits went into paradise, into the Hadean realm, the segment of it that would be paradise. Graphically, it would just simply look like this. The Hadean realm is represented by the entirety of this. Well, that's a total different color than what I've got on my screen, folks. The Hadean realm is represented by the entire oval, but there's a one segment of it that is torment. That's where the rich man found himself and was uncomfortable in the flames. The other half was paradise, and that is where Lazarus was, and the rich man desired Lazarus to leave paradise and to come to torment, but Abraham said it cannot be done because there's a great gulf that is fixed in between us, so nobody can pass from there to here, nobody can pass from here to there. That is the Hadean realm, what happens to our spirits when we die. Preacher in Tennessee did a sermon entitled "The Things in Hell That Should Be in the Church." And as he presented that lesson, I thought it was good enough that I copied it and did a version of it myself. But I want to give credit where credit's due. It was not an original thought with me. But as he's talking about the things that are in hell, he's talking about Tartarus because that is where we have more details. But I don't believe what we're seeing of the details in Tartarus is different from what exists in the eternal hell that you're going to go to. And so in Luke 16 is where he would draw his points from. Number one, something that's in hell that should be in the church is proper priorities. As you consider that rich man, while on earth, what he cared about was faring sumptuously every day, wearing purple and fine linen. He didn't care anything about spiritual matters whatsoever. He was focused on his physical appetites. But once you get to hell, you're going to recognize I should not have been focusing on the physical. I should have been intent with the spiritual matters of life. That priority should exist among Christians today. Within the church, we should see the things of this world are not the important things, but getting ready for eternal life is. Secondly, the regret of sin. The rich man didn't think anything about neglecting Lazarus while he was alive, but I'm sure it came heavy on his mind right now, thinking how negligent he was. And he wished that Lazarus would cross over from his place and bring just a drip of water to him to refresh him. That Lazarus would not neglect him like he had neglected Lazarus. But of course, Lazarus did not have the possibility of passing over that great gulf. Concern for others. When the rich man recognized that he could not get anything for himself, he got to thinking about his household at home where he had five brethren who were likely going to follow his example and wind up in the same place of torment, and he wanted Lazarus to go back from the dead and warn his brothers that they not come to this place. He had concern about them, and that needs to be within the Lord's church, that we're concerned about others within the congregation and those souls that are lost without the congregation. We need to be concerned for them. And finally, the recognition of the solution. Abraham said, Lazarus cannot go back. They have Moses and the prophets. In other words, they have the law of God. If they're going to avoid coming to torment, they got to obey the law of God. Now, for you and me, that would be the gospel. But for them, it was Moses and the prophets. But everybody who gets to hell is going to recognize, I could have been saved by obeying the gospel. That was the way to avoid this place. And part of the great torment that's going to be there is a person who had obeyed the gospel and then drifted away from it. or a person who never obeyed the gospel, though he heard the invitation offered many a time. These are disappearing values in the church. Our priorities have turned to great many physical things. Our sins don't seem to bother us as much as they used to. We're not concerned about others. We don't want them disturbing our time and messing up our afternoon. We're not recognizing the solution that the only way out of this is the gospel, as we start embracing all the denominations and all the false teachings and say we're all going to heaven, just in different ways. These are some of the attitudes that are prevalent within the Lord's people. Hell is cooling down in our rhetoric. We have a flyer in the back entitled Watering Down Hell. I haven't had opportunity to read it yet, but that's the idea. We're just not as uncomfortable with this place as we should be. And we need to get back to the place where we want to avoid hell at all costs. 12 times, the remaining 12, hell, it comes from a Greek word, Gehenna. Gehenna is a word that means the Valley of Hinnom. That was a valley that was south of Jerusalem. It was a despised place because in the Old Testament, the heathen god Molech, which looked like an oxen with a man's body, had a hollow cavity in its back and was made of bronze. It held its arms out this way, and when a fire was built in his back so that his chest would be glowing red, a baby would be laid in those arms, would slide into his chest and be consumed in the flames. Israel worshipped Molech at the Valley of Hinnom. And so when the New Testament came about, they were pretty sick of that place. Didn't like that they had that in their history. And so they made it their garbage dump. It's where they would throw their trash and their spoiled food. It's where they would discard bodies of animals that had been killed. And criminals that were not fit for burial would be tossed into the Valley of Hinnom. And a constant fire had to be kept burning to keep down the stench and the disease that would come from such a place. This physical place existed, and it's the word Jesus used to help them understand the eternal place where they're going to be going to if they don't serve God faithfully. 12 times we find the word Gehenna. 11 of those 12 times it's used by Jesus. And who would know better about what exists beyond this world than Jesus? And 10 of those 11 times, he's talking about a literal place. And I'm sure it rushes to a mind of some of you, well, what are the two exceptions? Real quickly. Figuratively, hell is used in Matthew 23 and verse 15 when Jesus talks about the Pharisees who search land and sea in order to make a proselyte, and when they make that proselyte, they make him twofold more the child of hell than yourself. That's not talking about a literal place. That's talking about a behavior, an influence. And then in James 3 and verse 6, the one time it's used that it's not Jesus speaking, he's talking about the tongue set on fire of hell. Again, a destructive influence. I'm not talking about the literal place. But all the other times the word is used by Jesus, there is talking about a literal place. In Mark the 9th chapter, verse 44, for instance, we read, "Where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched." This is a text where Jesus is talking about hell, and he uses the word Gehenna. He says three times that the worm is not going to die. And I think of that worm as probably being a maggot, that nasty little bug that goes and eats dead flesh. I had a dead bird one time in my yard. Marianne told me about it. I get to have the duties of cleaning that up. And I went out to pick up that dead bird, and I put on a rubber glove, and as I turned it over, maggots were all over the underside. And I'm a big tough guy, you know, and I was still freaked by that. I don't like bugs, especially maggots. But the maggots are not going to die in hell, and you know why? Because they eat flesh, and your flesh never gets consumed. It's always there. Five times we're told the fire is not quenched. Why? Because fire goes out when the fuel is burned up. Guess what's fueling that fire? You are! And you never die. It just keeps on burning you. Jesus says you want to avoid this place. Cut off your hand, cut off your foot, pluck out your eye, anything in this world that is going to cause you to stumble and go into that place, get rid of it out of your life. And yet, well,
but I don't want to stop smoking my cigarettes. I don't want to stop sipping my beer.
What about your hand? Would you cut that off? Do you realize how stupid we sound as we talk about these little trivial things that we're not willing to give up in order to avoid eternal torment? Well, there are many other verses that describe hell that don't actually use the word. One example of that is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Now here he's talking about those who are faithful Christians who are being tormented by other people. And he's telling us what's going to happen to those tormentors. He says in verse 8, in flaming fire taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. What's going to happen in that vengeance? Who shall be punished with everlasting destruction. Some people get all concerned about that word destruction. Anyway, well, that word destruction, that's talking about end of being. When something's destroyed, it ceases to exist. And so when we go to hell, we're going to cease to exist. No, destruction does not always refer to the end of being. It can refer to the end of well-being. And that's what hell is. No more pleasantries in your existence. Because he says everlasting destruction. It doesn't stop. From the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power. And this is the worst part about hell. You spent all your life trying to avoid God, trying to not submit to Jesus, and then at judgment day, you're going to see the Christ and you're going to confess my Lord and my God as you see his magnificence. You can't help yourself. And after you do it, he's going to turn around and you're never going to see him again. The greatest experience that ever happened in your existence, there and gone. That's what hell is. Separation from the presence of God. Matthew 8 and verse 12 says, but the children of the kingdom shall be cast out. The idea of being cast out of being separated from God into outer darkness, that thing that children are afraid of and we grown-ups are very uncomfortable, that place where all evil takes place, darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Weeping suggesting the idea of emotional pain. As we sob knowing I didn't have to come here. I had the opportunity to make it to heaven. I knew the truth. I obeyed the truth for a while, for a time. And then the gnashing of teeth representing the idea of physical pain that is going to be upon us in hell. When he says, but the children of the kingdom shall be cast out, he's talking about the children of Israel. This is a context where the centurion wanted the healing of his servant and told Jesus, you don't have to come to my house, just say the word and my servant will be healed. And Jesus said, I've not found so great faith in Israel. And then he mentions the kingdom of Israel where they're going to be cast out and the Gentiles are going to come and be a part of the Lord's people. We need to recognize that there are things invisible to our naked eye that are every bit as real as those things that are physically visible to us. Do we know that? In Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, we're told that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. Jesus came down here on earth. There were people who saw him and recognized him and knew what he was all about, and they were seeing the invisible God through Jesus Christ. The invisible God existed before Jesus set foot on earth, didn't he? He was still there. He was still real. And if Jesus had not come to earth, God would have still been real, even though invisible. Speaking further about Jesus, we're told that he was a creator of all things in heaven and in earth, visible and invisible. Do you recognize there's some invisible things in heaven and earth? Think about this in Jesus' day, where the Jews would look up into the sky and they could see the moon and what maybe was Venus. They weren't sure. It was just a little spot of light up there. And they saw a number of stars and the sun in the daytime. But that's it. They didn't have the Hubble telescope. They didn't have satellites. They didn't have rocket ships and space stations. All of these things that we've come to discover through our technology. You know what? They existed long before we discovered it. They were invisible to the naked eye, but they were still there. They were still real. And Jesus goes on to talk about these invisible things in regard to creation and how the unrighteous and the ungodly are without excuse. For the invisible things of him, that is God, his character, from the creation of the world are clearly seen. And that does not mean that God's attributes are physically seen, but perceived and understood by the things that are. When you see the destructive power of a hurricane, do you recognize that God has some juice? He's got some strength. When you see the beauty of a stream and a sunset, you think, oh, isn't God magnificent to paint such a beautiful picture of all things? When he provides the various kinds of fruits and the various kinds of fragrances, don't you recognize that if God gave all this stuff to us for a temporary time of so many years, imagine what he has for us in eternity? We can understand things about the attributes of God through creation, even though God is invisible to us. It's invisible, but it's real. Hebrews, the 11th chapter, is referred to as the Hall of Faith. It goes through Old Testament characters who, by faith, did something that was pleasing in the sight of God. In verse 7, Hebrews 11, 7 says, by faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, he is receiving a warning of God from something he's not observed. It may be that Noah never saw rain in his life. I'm not sure if it had ever come before that or not. But he never saw a worldwide flood. I know that. And yet, although he didn't see it, he believed it because God said it was going to happen. God gave him a warning of things that were invisible to him, things that had not happened yet, things that have not yet been observed. And he moved with fear or reverence toward God and started the building of the ark, which led to the saving of his house as well as the condemnation of the world, the rest of the verse tells us. But as we read that word by faith, what does that mean? The preceding verse, verse 6, says, but without faith it is impossible to please him. What kind of faith? We have faith in a lot of things. Some of you have faith in Purdue that they're gonna win it all. Some of you have faith in your wife that she's going to cook you a good dinner this afternoon. And on we have faith in all sorts of things. But what kind of faith is he talking about that's necessary to please God? Without faith it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Not only are we needing to believe in the existence of the true God, we need to believe in the power he has to reward and to punish. And to recognize if we're going to get a reward from him, it's going to be because we're diligently seeking him. We're doing our part in order to be saved. So Noah saw the punishment that was invisible until it actually came to be. And he couldn't start building the ark when it started raining, you know. He had to get it ready long before he ever saw it. But seeing this punishment through the eyes of faith, he acted upon what God said in order to avoid the punishment for himself and his family. Also in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, we read of Moses. And Moses was different in Noah in that he saw the reward and acted in a way that he would receive the reward instead of acting in a way to avoid a punishment. Hebrews 11, verse 24, beginning, we're told that it's by faith, the same type of thing, that Moses acted. A little later on, it says, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. He could look physically at all the treasures and wealth of Egypt and all the power where Pharaoh had, and he thought, well, that's nothing compared to what I see by faith that comes with God. For he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. As Noah acted fearing what God said, Moses acted not fearing what the king said. I'm going to follow what God says instead. The God who is invisible has much more power than any Pharaoh that I can look upon. They're invisible, but they're real. In Revelation chapter 20, verses 14 and 15, we read, and death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. Now, the word hell here is the word Hades. It's referring to the grave. And as he describes death and hell, I believe he's talking about the dead bodies are the death, He mentions the dead of that are in the sea. And the hell is referring to the dead, departed spirits. And so those dead bodies and those departed spirits are going to join themselves back together again at judgment. And they're going to be escorted into the lake of fire if they've been wicked. That lake of fire is the hell that we think about, the place of eternal torment, Gehenna. It's described as lake of fire. It's described as the second death. And we're told who's going to be there exactly. Whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. That is, are you a Christian? Did you die as a faithful Christian? If not, your name's not in there. And you're going to find this eternal torment. As we think about who might be in hell, recognize the list is rather large. Revelation 21 and verse 8 says, "But the fearful, the unbelieving, the abominable, and murderers, and whoremongers, and sorcerers, and idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." Clearly, he's talking about the second place, the same place that we've been talking about in the previous verse. And as he's talking about this second death, this lake of fire, telling us murderers are going to be there. Well, yeah, I'd expect that. Idolaters are going to go there. Yeah, okay. All liars? Well, wait a minute. I tell a fib every now and then. Guess what? That's where you go. The fearful. Wait a minute. I get scared to do God's will every once in a while. Guess what that means? The unbelieving, I've not yet obeyed the gospel. All these individuals are going to find themselves in eternal torment. It's the place of the ungodly. And we think about all the worldly people going there, but recognize that Christians can go there as well. In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus gives us three stories that deal with the idea of preparation. The first one is the 10 virgins. And we have 5 virgins of the 10 that did not have sufficient amount of oil. And so when the bridegroom came and went, they missed him. The doors were shut and they were locked out and not able to go in. That's the way it is when heaven's doors are shut to us and we're not able to go in because we weren't prepared, we weren't ready when the time came that Jesus sent for his servants to come. But the second one is the parable of the talents. And the parable of the talents describes an individual who received one talent, a sum of money from his master, which he hid in the ground and gave back to his master when his master returned. He didn't use it. He didn't bargain with it. He didn't invest it. He didn't do anything except hide it and gave it back to his master. He is described as an unprofitable servant in Matthew 25 and in verse 30. There it says, "And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." What do you think that's describing? That is where the unprofitable servant, the Christian who's not working in the Lord's service, is going to find himself. And the third illustration, Matthew 25, is a picture of a judgment scene where we have the left side where all the goats are gathered and we have the right side where all the sheep are gathered. And those on the right side are invited into heaven. But those on the left side are condemned. He says in verse 41, "Then shall he say unto them that are on the left side, Depart from me, ye cursed, in everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels." Can there be any question as to what he's describing there? Everlasting fire, where the devils are located. And the reason the people on the left go there is because of their neglect. Because they saw the least of Jesus' brethren who were hungry or thirsty or in prison or naked and did nothing about it. And so they will find themselves in eternal torment as well. But recognize as well, it's also a place of the hypocrites. Matthew 24 and verse 51. He's describing an incident of a servant who recognizes his master's not come back yet and starts abusing his privilege as a servant and mistreating other servants. And all of a sudden his master shows up and catches him at it. Verse 51 says, "And shall cut him asunder and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Again, describing hell as the place of hypocrites. So because I'm not totally ungodly, doesn't mean I don't have to think about hell. because that's where I'm going to go if I'm an unprofitable servant, not working faithfully in the Lord's kingdom. If I'm negligent to help out those who need my help, not willing to do the good that I could be doing. If I'm a hypocrite, acting like a Christian on the outside, but being contaminated on the inside, I'm not going to make it. Many behave the way they behave because they do not believe in hell. I think we recognize that all around us. There are people that are constantly behaving like there's no judgment to deal with. There's no eternal place that we're going to be. It's just this life, the here and now, and that's all we need to concern ourselves with. And so they behave the way they behave because they don't believe in an eternal hell. I want you to believe it. I want you to recognize the torment of it, to feel the heat of it, smell the smoke from it, get enough disturbed about it that you'll change your behavior to be consistent with what the Word of God teaches. If you are a Christian, then God bless you, but be a profitable servant. Don't be negligent of your responsibilities. Don't be hypocritical in your actions. If you are not a Christian, then you need to put on Christ, because those who know not God or obey the gospel are going to face the vengeance of the destruction and eternal punishment. If we can help you in any way to get right with God, we pray you'll come right now while we stand and while we sing.